Blog Talk Radio.
And the collective wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck, and I am happy to host this show. My guest this evening is progressive Democrat Jerry Polakoff. Jerry ran against Ray Allment in the 41st Congressional District for State House here in Lancaster County, PA, and perhaps given a few more weeks, he would have won. Jerry is a single-payer advocate and knows everything there is to know about enacting single-payer on the state level. He has some very exciting news to share with us tonight. And Jerry is what I call a Kennedy assassination scholar. Recently, last year, I had Jim Douglas on the show, author of JFK and the Unspeakable. And Jerry and Jim both agree the United States government killed President Kennedy. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Jerry Polakoff. Hello, dear Jerry.
Hi, Kate. How are you? Thank you for that introduction.
Thank you. Great to have you on. So,
I'm delighted to be here.
We have a lot to talk about here, a lot of ground to cover. I'm just wondering. I guess because I've been Twittering and Facebooking the single-payer crowd, let's start with how single-payer can only really be enacted on a state level, that what President Obama has in the health care bill and that's on the federal level, it has nothing to do with single payer. And as the health care bill was being put up and put forth, the single payer advocates in this country had horror, and we still have total horror for the bill that President Obama has put forth. And it's not because it's socialized medicine. Actually, it's because it's not socialized medicine that we are all upset. But anyway, let us know. First of all, I know that California, Vermont, and Pennsylvania are pretty much on the forefront of being able to enact legislation of a single-payer nature. And you ran on single-payer when you were running against Ray Allment in the 41st District. And I think that people were starting to get receptive to that whole idea. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about it. The thing that I think really just made an amazing point is I was endorsed by the Lancaster Intelligencer, which is not quite as Republican as its sister paper, The New Era, but it's really not a progressive Democratic paper by any means. And the thing that truly amazed me was that in endorsing me, they didn't find anything particularly wrong with Ryan Aument, who I ran against. And they said in any other year they might have endorsed him, but that the thing that made me stand apart as a candidate was my support for single-payer health care, which you could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean,
oh my gosh! You know, you must have presented it very well, is what I'm thinking.
Well, I guess I did, but it's not really a hard case to present. You know, a matter of fact, Barack Obama, as recently as last year, when he was, one of his public forums, conceded that the only way to get to universal health care was through single payer health care, and yet, before it ever really entered the stage of public debate or anything else, I mean, he took single payer off the table.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sorry to say that, you know, we have a government that is strongly beholden to special interests, but the bottom line is the cost of health care is going to bankrupt this country. Right now, you know, the rest of the world spends about 9% of its gross domestic product, and I'm talking about the other 33 countries that are part of the ONDCP, I believe it is, which is the Advanced Industrialized Countries of the World. 33 of them have universal health care, and they spend an average of 9% of gross domestic product on healthcare, and they cover everybody. We have more than 50 million uninsured. We probably have more than 100 million that are underinsured, which is almost the same thing because it means they can't afford to go to the doctor and pay the copays and deductibles when they get sick. And we spend we went from 16% of GDP last year to 17.5% this year, and if you back out the cost of military, and it's fair to do that because more than half of the world's military spending is accounted for by us. So if you back that out, I mean, we're up to 19% of gross domestic product and the cost of health care, and we still have a population that basically doesn't have health care. I mean, that's unsustainable, and those numbers keep going up. We cannot it's going to bankrupt Medicare. It's going to bankrupt Medicaid. We have, you know, calls for cutting back on Medicaid and Medicare because their costs are unsustainable. Well, their costs aren't unsustainable. It's the cost of health care that's unsustainable.
There you
and
go,
Obviously, those costs are part of the cost of Medicare and Medicaid. With Medicare, you have basically a – it doesn't radically change our health care system. You still have a private system, but it's publicly financed. And by the way, Medicare is a single-payer system.
Right.
What we mean by single-payer is there's really only – you get rid of the whole insurance company bureaucracy and you replace it with a one-payer – the government pays the bills. Mm-hmm. Basically, the government writes the checks. And that radically reduces the cost. It reduces fraud. It's proved over and over again in country after country that it's really the only way to go and the only way to get healthcare under control, healthcare costs. And we have to do it. We are literally going to be a third world bankrupt country if we don't do it. And the reason we have to do it on the state level is because, frankly, the special interests are so ingrained in Washington that it just isn't going to happen there. It will happen if one state passes it.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's what happened in Canada. It's such an advantage for that state economically, job growth, everything else, that then the dominoes start to fall, and that's how Canada became a single-payer country. Saskatchewan passed it. And then the dominoes started falling, and it took about 15 years, but eventually the entire country became a single-payer healthcare country, and we will do that here. And I'm glad to say, I mean, there are now – Pennsylvania looked like it was the state most likely to pass single-payer. Last year, we're still on a good track to do that, but now it looks like Vermont has moved out ahead. There's a – good chance California is going to pass it, and there's an insurgent single payer movement in Hawaii that
looks like it
could be successful. So it's if people think that it's gone away, you know, just because it's like if the tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, did it make a noise? I mean, the fact that the mainstream media doesn't cover this is irrelevant. It's happening, it's only a matter of time before we pass it, because we have to pass it.
There really is no alternative. Now, just to clarify, when it goes state by state, it wouldn't ever go federal, would it? Or are you saying that it would?
Oh, sure it would. I mean, it really makes sense, you know, to have it on a federal level, because, first of all, enforcement on a state level is difficult. The you know, they're the finances aren't there. The I'm not sure the will is there. It depends. I mean, Dennis Kucinich is a strong advocate for single payer health care, and Congressman Conyers, and they are both in favor of a nationally administered plan. Bernie Sanders of Vermont is a strong advocate for single payer health care, and he's in favor of a plan that's administered on the state level. In Canada,
Governor,
it's administered on the province level. So, I mean, those are things that could be worked out.
Yes, the governor of Vermont is extremely excited about signing single payer the legislation. So, I mean, that's a great state, and I think that I'm not sure, and it is irrelevant which state goes first. It's just that it's going to happen.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And,
I mean, obviously, as part of the Pennsylvania movement, I'd love to see us go first, but I don't care. I want to see single payer health care. And I mean, there are just too many people. I mean, over 40,000 people a year die in this country for lack of health care, and we got to do something about that. And I'm sure many, many, many thousands more than that suffer. What's going on in Vermont is that the governor, Peter Shumlin, actually ran on single payer.
That's
and
right.
He was elected, and we have a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate in Vermont, and the legislature set up a board to study different alternatives, three different options for health care, one of them being single payer. They hired Dr. William Hsiao, I think I'm pronouncing that right, H-S-I-A-O.
Mm-hmm.
He is the person that designed the Taiwan single payer health care plan.
Oh, that's so cool.
And he just came out with his report and recommendation, which is a bit of a hybrid, and that's fine. And he estimates that if Vermont passes that, it's going to reduce the cost of health care in Vermont by 12% to 14%.
Right. What did we decide what we would save here in Pennsylvania by enacting single payer? What are those figures? I know you probably know them.
We don't know. That's one of the things. You know, one of the things we've tried to do is fund an economic impact study. And
right.
Because there are companies out there that are expert at that. We've made estimates. We think it'll save billions of dollars. You know, the state is looking at a $3.5 to $5 billion budget shortfall this year. And we believe enacting single payer would save more than $5 billion a year. Ironically, we got a bill introduced in both the House and the Senate last year that would fund an economic impact study. And in the Senate, most states, this is a purely Democratic initiative. In Pennsylvania, in the Senate, we actually got 34 of the 50 senators to sign off on funding an economic impact study.
Right.
All 20 Democrats co-sponsored that. And 14 of the 20 Republicans co-sponsored.
Where is the
leadership never allowed it to get on the floor. 68%
right.
of the senators sponsored. This resolution, it never got to the floor, which is just a travesty. And what you alluded to earlier, and your readers are hearing it, or your listeners are hearing it here first. Our executive director Chuck Nacchio has worked very, very hard with the legislature and trying to pass this bill, and he's developed a lot of credibility. And one of the Republican co-sponsors of the bill was David Stile, who retired 2 years ago, but he was one of the original co-sponsors of the bill. He served 16 years in the legislature as a Republican House member. And he also is a small business owner. He owns a small manufacturing company. He is a passionate believer in single-payer health care. And we had our board meeting this weekend, and he has agreed and was elected the incoming president of Healthcare for All PA, which is the group pushing single-payer health care. That's truly a coup.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Yes, and we now have a Republican-controlled House and Senate, And it's, you know, to have a, you know, a single-payer healthcare movement chaired by a respected Republican is, you know, it's truly a coup.
I think it's wonderful. And
so,
then
we'll
when will he?
There is a lot of momentum out there, and also California. What most people don't know, thanks to the mainstream media, is that California has actually passed single payer legislation twice, and Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it both times. Well, now Jerry Brown is the progressive Democratic governor of California, and I would suspect that the legislature will pass it again, and that Jerry Brown will sign it. The only problem in California is because is that the rules, the law there is, even once it's passed, after it's passed, the funding mechanism has to be created, and then it has to, the funding mechanism has to be approved first by the legislature and then by the voters. So simply passing legislation is just the beginning.
Well, interestingly enough, we campaigned for Jerry Brown back in the early 90s. And he ran, his whole platform was based, his whole foundation of his whole, you know, presidency, running for president, was based on single payer. So there's no doubt he will sign it. It's just, he, like you say, it's a little more complicated. Here in Pennsylvania, we don't have all of that voter having to, the voters having to vote on it.
No, and the funding is included in the bill. The funding is included in the bill. So the, if the bill's passed, it's law.
Yeah. That's a little different, and what they have, and that's very complicated because California is a huge state with all those people, so they're going to have to a little bit of a time with that, I believe. But
and they're going to have to deal with, you know, if it goes on the ballot, you know, that the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and you know, the manufacturers of medical equipment and the hospital cartels are going to spend a lot of money to defeat it, and you know, it's, hopefully it will survive that process, but it's going to be a long, difficult road.
Yeah, you can just imagine what that will be like with the health, especially the health insurance companies, with all the propaganda, and yeah, we learned a lot about that kind of spin through the Wendell Potter book, Deadly Spin, and what they did to try to suppress the Michael Moore film, what his Cigna Health Insurance Company did to suppress that film. And that's pretty staggering. I mean, it's not that surprising, but these companies will go to any length to make sure that we don't have something as equal and as equitable, as something that is so necessary for the people of this country. And every other country has it.
We all owe a huge debt of gratitude to Wendell Potter.
Yes, we do. And, well, he'll be on the show in a few weeks.
Well, good.
We'll be discussing
his
book.
He's a friend
of
mine, and he's going to be, at my request, he's going to be coming to Lancaster, I hope, in the next few weeks.
Yeah,
and it's exciting, and I'm proud to call him my friend.
I am too. I think that's great.
We're so lucky to have had somebody. He's caught some grief for, you know, his role in promoting the health insurance industry. But you know what? If he hadn't done that, he would never have been in the position to do what he's doing now, which is expose them.
Yes.
So I think we should cut him some slack and give him some credit for having an epiphany and doing what's right.
Absolutely. I certainly do.
And I certainly do.
Yeah, he doesn't call himself a whistleblower, but everybody else does.
Right, he calls himself a truth teller.
A truth teller.
You know, I mean, in
yes.
the firm, you know, I mean, he's not giving away trade secrets, which is, you know, I guess where he draws the distinction. He's just exposing their practices, and he's from the vantage point of someone that was, you know, part of the propaganda machine.
Yes.
And one day he just realized that he couldn't in good conscience do that anymore. And I saw him, we both saw him at a program where you know, he was asked what made him come to that realization, and he fought back tears, and it took him a little while to respond, and he, you know, his response was, "I'm doing it for my children."
Right.
And I believe him.
I just wonder, you know, this is another thing. When you have jobs like that, and there's many, many other kinds of jobs like that where you're basically screwing people, how, you know, when you're on your deathbed and you're looking out back over your life, wouldn't it be just appalling to realize what you've done? I think so. And I think that really...
Well, people like you and I, and, you know, I mean, we have consciences, and it matters when, you know, when we look in the mirror, we want to see somebody we like. And people
yeah.
that feel that way have a hard time understanding how anybody wouldn't want to feel that way, wouldn't want to like themselves, wouldn't want to, you know, but I guess there, you know, there are plenty of people that don't seem to feel that way. So, you know,
yeah, I know.
Understand it. I mean, I just, you know, I can't understand. I mean, these people, you know, the world is full of sociopaths that, you know, or feel that that earning money and having power is worth the price of killing people. And I'm not like that, neither are you. And we'll never understand people who are like that.
Unfortunately, our whole political system seems to be populated with people like that. And the airwaves and television and Fox News and so forth are pretty much in it for themselves. And I just have to say this. I've said it before. But words have power, and this whole shooting in Tucson, Arizona, the climate of hate that you hear from the likes of Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck, I cannot understand how people do not connect the dots, and many people do. This is going to lead me into another question for you.
Okay.
I had said something to you recently that a poll had shown that the American public doesn't believe that words have power, that they don't understand how a crosshair over the congressional district of Gabby Giffords would have anything to do with her being shot. Now, explain to us how that probably how you look at polls, and how when I told you this recently, you just said, well, you know, it's all in the way that questions are asked, and it could really be that the American public actually does know that words have power. It's just that the way that the questions were asked is misleading, basically.
Exactly. You know, I don't ever, you know, when a new poll comes out, I don't ever read the news articles about the poll, or I may just look at them. You know, the bottom line is, you know, when you look at the actual poll, you look at the methodology, you look at the way the questions are asked. I mean, you can make a poll say anything you want. And for example, you know, and that happens all the time. That's why you see, for example, on healthcare, you know, the numbers are all over the board. You know, we hear that, you know, more than 50% of the public wants to get rid of Obama's health care bill. And I'm not a fan of that bill by any means. I'm not for rescinding it because people wouldn't understand why we're doing it. We would be rescinding it for the wrong reasons. What we need to do is move ahead and get it right. But, you know, when they ask that question, depending on how they ask it, you get huge differences. And you know, part of it is of the people that say they want to overturn the bill, when you ask them follow-up questions, you know, roughly a third of those want to overturn the bill because they don't believe it goes far enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, and again, even on healthcare, you know, if you do a healthcare poll that doesn't include an unlisted telephone sample frame, it's worthless, because today roughly one out of four households doesn't have a landline. They only have cell phones. And
yeah,
that segment of the population is radically different from the people who have landlines. They're bigger families. They're more likely to be minorities. They're more likely to be young. They're more likely to be economically challenged. They're more likely to be smokers. They're more likely not to have health care and to have health issues. And so if you do a poll that automatically excludes a quarter of the population that has radically different lifestyles and would answer those polls radically differently, then the poll is meaningless. So you really have to look at the poll. You have to look at the methodology. And you have to look at how the questions were asked. And very often you'll see two polls on the same subject that are done at almost identical periods of time with radically different outcomes because of the way the questions are asked.
So, and people don't realize that on the surface of things, the polls are more complex than they realize. And
yes, and they're not all, and they're very often, way too often, designed to produce a certain result rather than really find what people are thinking.
That's too bad, isn't it?
Yes, it is too bad. And I really believe that, you know, the news media does us a disservice by just constantly reporting on these polls without ever delving into them, without ever questioning the methodology, and it confuses the public. It's one of the reasons the public doesn't know what to think.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a form of brainwashing.
It is, and we don't like to think in this country that there are all kinds of propaganda machines at work out there to try to influence our thinking. And I must say that we are all vulnerable to this. For instance, today I was watching Amy Goodman. We've got rid of Comcast Television and instituted Netflix into the house, and I'm finally able to see Amy Goodman. It's the best news program on the planet. And she was she's at the, I think it's called the Sundance Film Festival this week, or at least the last 2 days. And they've created a film that sounds fascinating. It's about, and you would love it, this concept, Jerry. It's called A Hot Cup of Coffee, and it's something of that nature. And it has to do with the woman who had a hot cup of coffee spilled on her after she purchased the coffee from McDonald's. Remember that case?
I do remember that.
And she sued and so forth. Well, what was not explained at all to us, any of us, in this, and everybody was making fun of her all over the place. And actually, I didn't even know. She was like a 70-year-old woman. She had 16% of her body burnt, like third-degree burns, or the worst kind of burns. Maybe I don't remember. Is it first or third? I think it's first-degree burns are the worst. And of course, she did not have health insurance, and she needed to. And her quality of life was severely curtailed, and she never regained the quality of life that she had before the burns and so forth. We didn't know these things because there was a propaganda machine at work to make this whole thing look like she was some sort of opportunist. When in reality, it's the system at work here in this country. She did not have health insurance. She needed to pay for this. She needed to get well, and she didn't, and the access to care, I mean, in this country is terrible. I'm not saying that the healthcare system, I'm not saying that healthcare is terrible, but the access to care is terrible in this country. So
yeah, there's a difference between the quality of healthcare and access to healthcare. And the bottom line
absolutely.
Is if you don't have good quality health insurance and you don't have money, you don't have access to quality healthcare in the United States.
And from that point of view,
we have one of mm-hmm. the worst healthcare systems in the industrialized world, not because we don't have equipment and we don't have good doctors and we don't have good facilities, but because only people that can afford it have access to it.
Yeah, and my point though is that we're all vulnerable to being manipulated by these propaganda machines, by the McDonald's, by the McDonald's and the corporate powers that really do run this country. And as time has gone on, the corporations have started to run everything here. And, you know, I used to think it was just health care. Because I'm a nurse, you know, I used to think I have seen since I've been a nurse the overtaking of health care by the corporations, being mainly the pharmaceutical companies, by the health insurance companies, and so forth. But now I realize it's in every aspect of society. And
yeah, I totally agree with you, and we need to
be very careful of who we believe and the kinds of things. The spin, the deadly spin, as Wendell Potter has his the title of his book, it's pretty much out there, and certainly the corporate takeover of the media is especially staggering to me. But
and I'm really concerned that we're now looking at a corporate takeover of the internet,
and I'm very concerned about
really
that.
The only, you know, we need to let Barack Obama and the Democrats know we're not going to stand for that. Because right now, I mean, we've seen the beginning of the end of net neutrality, which really is equal access by everybody and every website and every company to the fast lane of the internet. And
yeah.
Without it, it's very threatened. And frankly, the merger of Comcast and NBC is very scary. That kind of a conglomeration in media would never have been tolerated even a few years ago, and it's a real threat to freedom of speech and to our ability to be, you know, our right to be informed.
And it certainly threatens the very core of our democracy.
The departure of Keith Olbermann from MSNBC is unrelated, but I have my doubts.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. It seems to me that Keith Olbermann was having some problems with the powers that be at NBC anyway, for a long time. But on the other hand, a lot of people do think that the merging of Comcast and NBC and then all of a sudden Olbermann is gone is very suspicious. And nobody can convince. Yeah, we can't be convinced that. Well, it's completely unrelated when there is no such thing.
No, and remember, you know, there's been a pattern for this. I mean, you know, I don't know how many people are old enough to remember this, but back during the Vietnam War days, one of the most popular television programs was the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Well, I certainly remember
them.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I certainly
remember them.
It was
very political, and it was very progressive. And because of that, CBS started demanding that they submit tapes of the program 24 hours in advance so that they could edit and censor them, and the Smothers Brothers resisted that. And because they resisted it, you know, one of the few times in history that a top-rated show was summarily canceled. Canceled on a day's notice, by the way. You know,
it's just like this. Just like
you know,
this.
Basically, CBS didn't get their tape on time, so Smothers Brothers were history. And
well, you know, I...
Phil Donahue. You know,
oh,
I mean,
Phil
Donahue,
Donahue is another one, yeah.
And it happened to Bill
That's
Maher
right.
when he was on ABC. And you notice it only happens to progressives.
Yeah, I'm very disgusted by this whole thing. Did you hear the Connecticut is pushing for Olbermann to run in Lieberman's place, Joe Lieberman?
No, I think that would be wonderful, except he'd be missed if he didn't go back to the airwaves.
We need him on the airwaves, you know.
But you know, it wouldn't hurt to have a few Keith Olbermanns and God, I'm drawing a blank from Saturday Night Live, who's now the senator from Minnesota.
Franken.
Right, Al Franken. I mean, we could use
yeah.
a few more people like that.
Yes, we can, in politics. And actually, Al Franken is at the very head of this net neutrality battle.
Yes,
and you can't tell, first of all, okay, I have to say that we probably don't have to really, really worry about this merger in the sense that all of our free speech will be taken away. When you look at all the progressive the whole progressive movement on the internet, the Huffington Post and all of the other Daily Kos and op-ed news that we all love and admire on the internet, and all of our blogs where we just say wherever, whatever we want to say. And not only that, but here we are on Blog Talk Radio. We can say whatever we want to say. There's no way.
Yeah, but, but those are all threatened by the departure of net neutrality.
Yeah.
And actually, I was talking with Rob Call about this. Rob is the owner of Op-Ed News.
Right.
And he can, you know, the bottom line is if you get relegated to a second slower tier, you know, your ability to survive is really threatened.
Yeah.
And that's what we're in danger of seeing.
Now, what I would like to know is what is somebody like Rob Call going to do about it? Because he is sort of like, you know, the guy who owns and runs Op-Ed News. And what are the people who are really affiliated with these progressive news agencies? What are they going to do about it? Are they going to get together and do something?
Well, they're sounding the alarm. I don't know what they can do other than sound the alarm and say, don't let this happen.
Well, I think a lot of lawyers are working on it.
Yes. And even, the progressives aren't the only ones that are worried about this. I mean, conservatives are worried about it, too. You just can't have a system on the internet where those who can afford to pay get privileged access to people that, you know, with computers. And,
right.
You know, we've already seen, you know, it's very easy to shut down a website if all of a sudden websites that can't pay for a higher tier are relegated to a lower, slower tier. It'll be even easier to, you know, well, they may not even need it. We have to protect free speech and free access to the internet. We have to.
Yes, and so I'm sure that we will get together and do something about this. All of us.
Now, at least we're aware of it. And
yeah, it's not something that happened.
And
we have to do nothing about it.
I don't care. You know, I voted for Barack Obama, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners did. But we have to realize that Barack Obama is, you know, doesn't consider himself a foe of business or corporatism, and maybe he shouldn't. But, you know, the more he kowtows to, you know, to corporations and business, the more threatened the rest of us are. And we need to hold him accountable and make sure he realizes that he's not going to get a free ride from progressives or anyone else.
No. You know, he plays both ends against the middle. He hopefully tonight on the State of the Union will say that he wishes to preserve Social Security, and he doesn't wish to, and he won't allow the retirement age to be raised. But I think I heard that he's going to back off of that, and I think he needs to take a stand, especially if he really wants to be reelected. I mean, you know,
it's not enough to say nothing. It's not enough to say we have to consider, he needs to say that Social Security is off the table. You know, I mean, and let's face it, this is something else you don't hear in the media. Social Security has run trillions of dollars in surpluses over the years. It is totally self-sufficient. It doesn't drain $1 it doesn't contribute $1 towards the deficit. And something I actually just learned today is it's legally forbidden to contribute to the deficit.
That's good.
The only real
reason
that a lot of Wall Street people want to take down Social Security is because the government has borrowed $2.5 trillion from the Social Security Trust Fund, and they don't want to pay it back. How are we going to fund the next bailout, and how are we going to fund tax cuts for the rich if we have to give $2.5 trillion back to the Social Security Trust Fund that, you know, that we stole? I'm sorry to put it that way, but that's what it comes down to. It's not that there's anything wrong with Social Security. It works just fine, and it's stable, and it's not in need of rescue. What's it in need of having the money that was looted from it returned.
Well, that's true, and let me just mention that the baby boomers are reaching the age of where we will be receiving Social Security at record numbers, unheralded in any other time in history. You know, this all of us are reaching 60. You've reached that. I'm just about to reach it. All the bit, you know, we're just about to take over the old age movement. You know, we might as well. We need to have a new paradigm about aging gracefully and embracing age and you know, being pioneers in this whole thing. Well, that also means that we will not allow people to mess with our Social Security and our Medicare. But unfortunately,
right.
As far as everything you said about Social Security is true, but what I'm worried about too is that Medicare has been taken over by insurance companies. It used
right.
to be a single-payer thing, and we, you know, like to say that it's a single-payer program, but I don't really think it is anymore. I think it's been co-opted by the insurance companies. We need to change that and put it back to where it was before.
I totally agree with that. It is in theory. Well, it's a you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
It's in theory a single-payer system, but you're right. It's been privatized. And that's driven up the cost. And there is no question, nobody disputes the fact that the cost of Medicare,
mm-hmm.
because of the cost of health care, is unsustainable.
Right.
So if we don't fix it and don't get the for-profit insurance companies out of there, we're going to lose it. And,
yes.
You know,
could you explain to our listeners and our future listeners the exact nature of what privatization is all about?
Well,
because I don't think people understand what that means. They don't understand how dangerous it is.
You mean privatization of Medicare?
Of anything at all, but let's say Medicare and Social Security, they want to privatize that. They want to privatize.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, look at the financial crisis. You know, look at the fact that the entire world almost went into a depression last year, and we're not safe yet. We could still see that happen, and that was because of the massive deregulation of the banking
mm-hmm.
industry that began during the Reagan administration and continued into the Clinton administration. And frankly continues to this day. It scares me that Barack Obama announced last week that we needed to see more deregulation. I don't think that's the cure for the financial crisis.
Right.
What happens is you can't trust, you know, let's face it, corporations have one mission by law. Their mission is to make money. Their mission is to create the greatest possible return for their stockholders.
Mm-hmm,
and I honestly, we can't even fault them for that. That's their mission. What we have to do is protect the public from, you know, being at the mercy of that mission. And
right.
Because there's nothing inherently, corporations are not in the business of creating jobs. They're in
right.
the business of making money. They're not in the business of looking out for the welfare of the American people. They're in the, you know, and that's why they outsource jobs, because they can save money by outsourcing jobs. They can save money by manufacturing their products overseas. And one of the reasons they can save money by manufacturing overseas is because most of those countries have universal health care, and a big cost of business is not insuring that's a big cost. You know, business costs in this country that other countries don't face, which is why
yeah.
it's more expensive to manufacture here. But the bottom line is, I mean, look what's happened. We've had this huge wave towards, you know, free trade and free markets, and look what's happened. I mean, we've lost millions of jobs. The wages for, you know, the average American, the when you adjust wages for inflation, our lifestyle is going in the wrong direction. We're making less money, not more, while the
mm-hmm.
CEOs are making, you know, just obscene amounts of money that they didn't
right.
make before all this was going on. And the gap between the richest 1%, and the rest of us is just getting wider and wider and wider. That's what third world countries are made of.
Yes.
We don't have to speculate. I mean, the evidence is all around us. You can't take, and the healthcare industry is another example. We're the only country in the world where the gatekeepers of healthcare are the pharmaceutical companies and the for-profit insurance companies. And look at what we got for it. I mean, we have a totally dysfunctional system that doesn't work and is going to bankrupt the country. So it's not really a philosophical argument. The evidence is all around us.
Exactly. Now, doesn't the privatization of something like Social Security mean also that they're going to put it all in the stock, all the money in the stock market?
Well, I'm not worried about Social Security being privatized. I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay.
But what they're trying to do is, I mean, Bush tried that, and he didn't get anywhere with it. But what they're trying to do is make the American public believe that Social Security is in danger of collapsing and is unsustainable. It isn't. I mean, it's got, almost a $3 trillion surplus if you count the IOUs from the Treasury, which, by the way, are legal obligations. And it's not in any danger. At the very worst, what is it? I think with the current figures in there, I mean, it could operate at full benefits till the year 2038. And that doesn't even assume financial growth.
Right.
All you have to do is, I mean, if you got rid of the caps, because remember, I mean, the most anyone, you can make $1 trillion a year. You're not going to pay more than, I think, $106,000 into the Social Security Trust Fund. We need to get rid of those caps. They don't belong there. There are lots of ways to, the Social Security is not in danger. And if it does become in danger, we'll know it in plenty of time to tweak it. Maybe we should tweak it now. Maybe we should improve benefits. It would be nice if people had, on Social Security, had a living wage, because they would spend that money and would grow the economy.
Yes.
But it's the real reason, and some of the big honchos in Wall Street even admit it, is that they feel we will bankrupt the government if we have to repay the money that was borrowed.
Yeah, there it is, right
maybe
there.
Maybe they're, I mean, we lent trillions of dollars to Wall Street, and at incredibly good terms. How can we justify doing that and not paying back the money we borrowed from Social Security?
Yeah, I mean, the whole message is that we need to pay back our debts. And why would you shirk that responsibility?
Control so much of our debt. Guys, we're glad you lent us that money, but we're not going to pay you back. We can't afford it.
Yeah, that one, that doesn't go over very well, does it?
No. So it's just very few people understand this, not because it's a complicated case to be made. It's because the media never talks. How many people know that the Social Security Trust Fund has $2.6 trillion in government IOUs sitting in it?
They don't know.
And it's not an Einsteinian concept.
Right.
You really don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand this.
Well, I just can't understand then. I know that people like our president know exactly what you just said, that Social Security is not in any danger. So why are they all these politicians playing along with this whole thing? What is their reasoning?
Because the push to cut back Social Security and to raise the retirement age is coming from Wall Street, and it's coming from multi-billionaires like Pete Peterson, who spent most of his life trying to
And that Boehner guy.
Yeah, I mean, the politicians have been bought by the special interests. And it just Wall Street. I mean, I hate to say it, but you know, when you look at the people that have counseled Obama, and I'm talking about Orszag and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and Geithner. I mean, these people have all been for years advocating for radically changing Social Security, and it's for the same reason. It's because of their, you know, they're tied to corporate interests, and corporate interests. It's not in the interests of the big corporations in this country and the bankers and Wall Street for the government to write a $2.6 trillion check to the Social Security Trust Fund. It really is that simple.
Yes, it is. Wow. Amazing. Well, it all kind of reminds me of, you know, when Jim Douglas was on our show and here on Blog Talk Radio, and he said that things have gotten a lot worse since the Kennedy assassination. I know I'm switching gears here, but it seemed like, you know, the worst thing in the world that could ever happen was the assassination of a beloved president. And here we are, you know, 50 years later, with things much more entrenched and much more in danger of, you know, of CIA doing things that are despicable, and the whole Julian Assange WikiLeaks case is a case in point of our government going out after him when what he's doing is just revealing things that we need to know about for instance, why we go to war. Maybe we need to really know everything about a situation, and then maybe we won't go to war and stuff like that.
I agree. And the thing that Douglas, I mean, his book really, what it does is it puts the assassination in an historical context. You know, it's not really a book about the single bullet theory or how many shots were fired from where. You know, it's about the world that we were living in 1963, and frankly, what I believe, again, was a Kennedy epiphany, and it's something that he articulated in his famous Georgetown University speech, or American University speech.
Right.
Where, you know, we all breathe, we are all mortal, and we breathe the same air, and if we don't want our children growing up in a nuclear-polluted world, we need to live together and we need to work together. And it really was a call for the end of the Cold War. It's been amply demonstrated that Kennedy had realized that Vietnam was a mistake and he was going to get us out of there. We know that he realized that we had a renegade power in the Central Intelligence Agency. And Douglas does a very good job of basically revealing all that and expanding it and connecting the dots in a way nobody's ever done it before. It's not really a unique perspective, but he does a beautiful job of pulling it together and connecting the dots. And,
yes. Because
people say, why would the CIA have wanted to kill Kennedy? And that's the question that Douglas answers, and he does it very articulately. And
see,
everybody should read that book.
Yeah, they really should. JFK and the Unspeakable by Jim Douglas. What people would rather believe about the Kennedy assassination and all the assassinations, well, mostly the Kennedy assassination, probably of Bobby Kennedy too, was that they would rather believe that the mafia killed these men. Because
we got to remember, you know, there is evidence of mafia involvement in the John Kennedy assassination. But you also have to remember that the mafia was working with the CIA to try to assassinate Castro. So it's, you know, if you can, you know, to link the mafia to the Kennedy assassination doesn't exonerate the CIA.
No. In fact, they were all working kind of like in the same undercover kind of movements. One was a member of the CIA was also a member of the mafia. So it was all sort of linked
up. I mean,
up.
They clearly were mafia ties. You know, Jack Ruby clearly had mafia ties. I mean, there really are mafia figures that are all over the Kennedy case, but they were also involved in trying to kill Castro. And many of them were on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. So it's, you know, you can, it doesn't work to say the mafia killed JFK. And I don't believe the mafia had the power to, you know, I mean, the mafia could not control the parade route. The mafia certainly couldn't make sure that the body got back to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where a panel of military doctors could be ordered how to conduct the autopsy and to conduct an incomplete autopsy. I mean, if somebody could explain to me how the mafia could have done that, I'd like to hear it.
I just had a thought. Wouldn't it be great to get you and Jim Douglas on this show and talk it out a little bit? That would be really fun. It would be really fun. We'll try to work that out. You know, one of the things that Jim Douglas discusses about the Kennedy, the motive behind the Kennedy assassination, you know, just imagine in 1963, I mean, we were alive and well, and we knew how uptight everything was before, you know, the freedom, 1960s freedom stuff all broke loose, the civil rights movement and the flower children and all that great stuff. But so right before that, you know, you have the Kennedy Camelot thing happening, and those people in his government were some of the most uptight people I've ever seen in my life. I mean, they really looked very uptight. And then you have John Kennedy and his wife and his family and so forth. They were this so full of vitality.
They were. And, so, you know, I was a kid, and I was totally, you know, I was totally swept up by it. I remember as a kid and, you know, and living in Forest Hills, New York, and crawling on my hands and knees to get to the front of the line, or to get to the front of a crowd so, you know, I could touch John Kennedy when he was a candidate.
He was very magnetic, wasn't he? I had the same experience down in Lancaster Square. I was on my brother's shoulders, and he took me down to see John Kennedy. Suddenly, I just darted off his shoulders and ran, the same thing that you're describing. And he was so upset because he was responsible for me, and I disappeared. Because there was so much magnetism. You saw the man in person, and, you know, you were drawn you just wanted some of that, you know, because everything else in that time period was completely uptight. So what I wanted to say about Jim Douglas and everything is that at the time when John Kennedy decided that nuclear war was an abomination, that he knew that we just could not go that route, that was when it all closed in on him, because he you know, had this wonderful communication with Nikita Khrushchev that was unbelievable, which, once again, our media wanted to make Nikita Khrushchev into some sort of crazy guy, when in reality
they liked each other. They had a mutual respect for each other. And and I think that may have been Khrushchev's undoing, too.
Yes. So it had to do with the conscience of these men and not wanting to go the route of using a nuclear bomb, which would have destroyed the planet. And that was the real reason. And he took a stand. He didn't, you know, kowtow to the powers that be just to make his life more comfortable. He stood up for it, and he died for it.
Yeah, and, you know, there's various opinions of this. I mean, I've kind of believed that Kennedy was a very different person when he was elected. It was kind of a cold warrior that, you know, had an epiphany when the responsibility of the presidency and the future of the world was resting on his shoulders. There are a lot of people that feel that he really, you know, that it wasn't an epiphany. It was just something that took a little while to gel, or that he kept under control until he was more confident. I don't know which one it is.
Yeah.
But I have no doubt that he was, you know, whether design or because of an epiphany, it doesn't really matter, but he was a different president in the last year of his life. And he was pushing a very, very different agenda, and he certainly wanted to see an end to the Cold War. He certainly wanted to get us out of Vietnam. He certainly wanted to rein in the CIA. And those are all good things. It would be a very different world if he had lived and succeeded in doing those things.
Yes, it would. And Jim Douglas made the comment that things are not are much worse now than they were then. And every now and then I can see a glimpse of exactly what he's talking about.
And let's not forget that, you know, I mean, and Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and Martin Luther King was assassinated. And
Malcolm
X. Even Malcolm X. And Malcolm X was, you know, really, he was in a transition, too. He was moving away from, you know, confrontation. He was learning to, you know, he was another person that I think had an epiphany and realized that there was a different road that could be more effective, and then he was assassinated. And
yes.
It seems that whenever anybody comes forward and really decides is in a position to make a difference and tries to make a difference, we lose them. And,
yes, well, there was a speech that Martin Luther King gave 1 year to the day of his assassination, at Riverside Church in New York City. That was the most – have you heard that speech? It's I think it's kind of like one of those things that's been –
I probably have, if you remind me which one.
Yeah, well, this one has to do...
I don't really associate his speeches, except for the mountaintop, for a particular day or time or place.
Now, this one had to do with the imperialism of the United States government, you know, to go into Vietnam.
Oh, was that the one where he came out against the Vietnam War?
Yeah, get out of the Vietnam... The Vietnam
yes.
War. And then...
And that
and
was a turning point for him.
It was. That was.
Yes,
and
I am familiar with that speech. I just didn't remember where it was given.
Well, the only reason I know is I just heard it the other night and in its entirety. And he basically calls the United States and its foreign policy as just total bully. We are the bullies of the world. How dare we do what we've done? And it's really embarrassing to me to think about how you know, and now the latest stuff on torture and how we are torturing Manning in the prison. And I guess that prison is in this country. You know, there's all...
Yeah, it's Fort Benning, Georgia, I believe, isn't it?
So it might be Virginia. But Georgia sounds like more of a possibility.
I'm not sure. Well, it's a military facility.
Yeah, it is a military facility.
He hasn't been charged with anything. He hasn't even been charged.
And he's
being held in there's a very good column on that in Glenn Greenwald, who's been really reporting on this.
Oh,
along.
I have to read that
excellent
stuff.
Excellent column on that today at Salon. I would urge your...
I will read that. Yeah,
he's been writing about it very well, but one of the things he pointed out today is that, you know, it's now becoming popular for people to, you know, minimize what's happening to Manning and accuse the people that are talking about it of making a case for him and ignoring all of the other horrible things that go on in prisons. And Glenn Greenwald exposes that for a total lie and basically, you know, points out that the technique that these people use is to never... You know, some say, and we've heard, and which, you know, is very easy to say when you don't link or identify. And he went on to point out that it's basically a lie, that the people that have argued against what we're doing to Brian Manning have been arguing, you know, fighting against us doing that anywhere, whether it's to political prisoners or anybody else. But he also points out that in this case it's especially reprehensible because the whole purpose is to intimidate whistleblowers and to frankly get Manning to incriminate Assange.
Which apparently they really didn't have any contact whatsoever.
Right. And even if they did, it's no, you know, that doesn't make it a crime.
It doesn't.
It's no question it's not a crime. If they did, they might be able to manufacture something. But, you know, the bottom line is they're trying to create a crime where there is no crime.
Exactly. It doesn't matter to me at all whether that he had any communication with Assange at all. But the point is that he didn't. And
right.
there's a spin, and the spin is that that the CIA wants to bring Assange to this country so that they can give him the death penalty. The whole thing is just so
right.
unbelievable.
Or at the very least, shut him up. But you know, since when is it legal in this country to take somebody, not charge them with anything, throw them in prison, put them in solitary confinement, deprive
them
of their Yeah, deprive them of their clothes, not let them, you know, last week they put them in, this is something else that Greenwald talks about today. You know, they last week they put him on suicide watch, and it was the commander of the prison that decided to do that. That's illegal. Only a medical professional is allowed to do that. And it frankly was a punishment. You know, the man hasn't been, you know, if they've got if he's guilty of something, charge him and put him on trial.
Right.
You know, they put this guy in jail and they're doing anything they want to him. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, that's illegal and people should go to jail for doing it.
Yes. And unfortunately, we all have our hands tied and people may or may not even care about Bradley Manning, but I think we definitely should care. This is not the way we need to conduct business in this country. We are much better than this, and we should hold that prison and the way we're acting towards people like him and torturing people accountable.
And frankly, if he did what they say he did, we should be giving him putting a medal on his chest.
Yes, because he's showing something that is reprehensible. You don't just shoot people from an airplane. It's almost like, reminds me of that situation in Vietnam.
My Lai?
Oh, my gosh. My Lai is what it reminds me of, yes. Doesn't it, you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
we're
supposed to be better than that. I mean, it's not... You know, we're becoming a rogue nation, and that's very unfortunate. I mean, you know, we're supposed to stand for something here, and we're losing our values, and we really are. You know, I mean, the rest of the world is looking at us, at least, you know, the civilized world. They're looking at us as a rogue. I mean, they're not, you know, we're doing things that are universally, internationally regarded as war crimes.
Yes.
And we're supposed to be better than that. We're supposed to be the shining beacon, you know, that stands for something. And, you know, I don't think we can say that anymore.
No,
and I think that it would be different if you know, we hadn't had all of those assassinations starting with John Kennedy.
I think so too.
Jim Douglas
yes.
is very right. It would be a very different world.
Yeah.
And it would certainly be a different United States of America.
It would. Well, the point of the matter is that we have to be whistleblowers to our government and just let it be known that most people in this country do not really believe. If they knew the truth.
And you know we're both going on the Do Not Fly list for saying this on the air.
Well, we're going to draw. Who wants to go into those TSA machines anyway? Well, I'm sure that, like I said, I think the American public needs to hold our government accountable. We just don't let them get away with everything. And believe it or not, the most important thing that a person can do is vote and become informed and not become informed by thinking like me. I don't mean that. But just
well,
to
no,
think
you know,
for
Kate,
themselves.
I live in, and you know, you live in, you know, next door, not in the same district, but I live in what's supposed to be a very conservative district, in a very conservative county. When the Democrats came to me, I didn't go to them. When the Democrats came to me and asked me to run, and it was largely based on, I believe, my success in organizing for single-payer health care, I warned them that, you know, I was not the kind of person to toe the Democratic line, and I was not the kind of person that would just go out and speak Democratic talking points.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine with them. And when I accepted the endorsement of the Lancaster County Democratic Committee, I got up and I made a very short speech. I basically thanked them for the honor, and I said I just want everybody to know that I am a proud progressive, and I'm going to run as one. And I did. And now
mm-hmm.
this year, you know, we had a tsunami, and there was no one that was going to win. But you know, I was at the bottom of the ticket, and I ran 3 points behind Joe Sestak, who was at the mm-hmm. top of the ticket, which really
right.
is extraordinary. I mean, you know, I didn't have anywhere near the exposure or the name recognition, but I kept to my word. I got good press. I was endorsed
mm-hmm.
by the newspaper. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and thanked me for
yeah.
keeping my word and running a progressive campaign. And I do think in any other year I would have won. And
I think so, too.
It's, and, you know, the fact that I did as well as I did in this red conservative district tells you something. And and progressive is not a dirty word. And it basically means you care more about people than corporations.
Right.
And, you know, you care about things that matter to ordinary people. And it wasn't very difficult for me to keep my word because that's just, you know, that's who I am. But
yeah.
I think it made a difference to a lot of other people because they're not used to seeing somebody that you know, will, you know, that basically resists. And there were people in here that wanted me to not run on any issues, just say, tell people to go out and vote for the straight Democratic ticket, which I would never, ever, ever do.
Right.
But I think there were a lot of people that were, you know, very grateful to me for, you know, saying I would run as a proud progressive and for doing that. And even our right-wing newspaper, you know, most mm-hmm. of the press I got was very positive. I think I was a breath of fresh air because I said what I believed, and I didn't care if, I mean, you know, I was pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
I was endorsed by Kate Michaelman, the former president of NARAL. I was endorsed by all the women's groups, by the AFL-CIO, and they endorsed me because of what I stood for. And when I was criticized for being that liberal in such a conservative district, I said, you know, I'm not voting based on me. I'm not saying what I say based on talking points that are added to me. I'm saying what I believe in, and hopefully people will respect me for doing that.
Right.
And will think about voting for me even if they don't agree with me. And I think a lot of that did happen. And in any other year, I really do think I would have won. But I did extraordinarily well relative to the top of, you know, for a person at the bottom of the ticket relative to the top of the ticket. I got 34% of the votes. Joe Sestak mm-hmm. got 37% of the votes at the top of the ticket. And that's pretty remarkable.
Well, now, getting down to the fact that you did not run as a status quo Democrat, and I think that could be one of the major contributions of that campaign that you ran, because so many other people all over this country run as either a status quo Democrat or a status quo Republican, which is run by the corporations once again. And what happens there is that there's no difference between the two parties. And what you have done is hopefully blazed a trail for people to see that running as a status quo anything isn't going to really change the world or do anything to contribute to anything.
And, you know, the other thing is that I did a very respectable job of fundraising. And guess what? I had no corporate money, surprise. I had no Democratic, you know, I did get support from the local Democratic clubs. I didn't get a mm-hmm. dime from the state Democratic committee, even though
right.
I was running for an open seat. And that should have, you know, according to their own guidelines, that should have generated some financial support. But I was also running against what I call the culture of entitlement in Harrisburg, and I was running against a lot of the corrupt practices up there, and that wasn't going to ingratiate me to the Democratic Party, you know.
Right.
But I didn't care. I generated enough money to we were able to mount a television campaign. We were able to mount a 10-day newspaper campaign. We had about 20 to 30 people making phone calls and knocking on doors.
Right.
And, that was without, it was almost all individual contributions. I got $2,500 from Progressive Majority.
Yeah.
I got $500 from Ceasefire PA, $250 from Ceasefire PA, and I got some money from the Democratic clubs, and the rest of it was all individual contributions. And it just shows, I didn't take a position that I wouldn't accept PAC or corporate money because I knew I wasn't going to get any,
Let's make it clear to our listeners and our future listeners that here in Lancaster County, and, in particular, the district that you were running in, and I know that things are changing demographically, but traditionally, Lancaster County and Lancaster, Pennsylvania is the most conservative areas in Pennsylvania. However, progressives like yourself, Jerry, have changed. What is going on here? We have a huge progressive movement here, and we started out at your house probably in 2006 and had our regular Progressives for Pennsylvania meetings every week. And I'm sorry that this
And we started that with our, we were, just to remind your audience, that we were the Chuck Pinocchio campaign in Lancaster County, and Chuck is a wonderful progressive who was running for the Senate. And we still all look up to him, but that was the beginning of our, then we kept our organization going. And frankly, it was a hell of a testament to what we had accomplished that the Democrats in Lancaster came to me and asked me to run for that seat. And I would also point out that the Democrats need to start acting like Democrats, because one of the problems was, and I don't even know the numbers from my district. I haven't had a chance to look at them, but I learned yesterday in the county, the Republican turnout last November was 58%, and the Democratic turnout was 38%. And that's because Democrats are getting tired of voting for Democrats who then become a majority and end up supporting a Republican/blue dog agenda. And this year they said a pox on both your houses and they stayed home.
Yeah, that's really sad.
That's going to keep happening if we don't, wise up.
Yes, it is. And once again, I really think that you are a great example, and it might really aggravate certain people, but in the end, they have to really look deeply into themselves as to what a true Democrat is, in the true sense of what a Democrat is. Starting, it's almost like what the Republicans need to look at what a true Republican is. Ike Eisenhower, if he ran today, would not be running as a Republican, and he was one of the greatest. He was one of the greatest Republicans that ever lived.
That's very true.
The same could be said of our Bill Clinton. As much as everybody loves Bill, the fact of the matter is that he sold out the Democratic Party.
I always referred to Bill Clinton as the best Republican president we ever had. And I don't know if that verbiage just naturally occurred to other people, or whether it kind of hit a grapevine and got around, but Michael Moore used the same phrase in Stupid White Men. but I said it first.
Right on. So what other things did you learn from running for your congressional seat?
Well, it was just, it really was inspiring. In the beginning, it was very difficult because there were a lot of people that were making promises. I had never run before, and there were people making promises to help me, get my campaign launched and do this and do that. And I found that, the support, the words were much greater than the deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very difficult getting untracked, getting a a campaign team put together. But when we finally did that, I mean, I had a wonderful campaign team, and everybody really believed that we could win, and they were all out giving their heart and soul, and everybody worked for nothing. I had a webmaster did the website pro bono, and it was it really was very, very rewarding from a personal point of view, and it humbled me too. I mean, you know, see that, you know, there were people that I know that you know are financially, you know, just don't have a lot of money, and there were people that I knew couldn't afford it that, you know, contributed $200-$300 to my campaign. And I started feeling guilty, started out feeling guilty about that, and, you know, commenting like, these people really can't afford this. And people would say, you know, did it ever occur to you that they can't afford not to? And, no, it really, it is very humbling. I mean, and
that is humbling, yes.
And,
yeah.
You know, it became an inspiration, and in the beginning, I was wondering why I ever agreed to do it. You know, the last several months, I actually started having fun. I really thought I was going to win. I woke up on election day thinking I was going to win.
Right.
But I don't think any of us realized what was really going on out there, and now it's clear just from the numbers in terms of who voted and who didn't. The Democrats, you know, I mean, you know, one of the other things, you know, and again, just to kind of put it in context, it wasn't, you know, progressives actually did fairly well on Election Day.
Yeah.
And only two members of the Progressive Caucus were defeated. Half the Blue Dogs were defeated. Mm-hmm. And according to Gallup, and in this case, I feel comfortable talking about this because we're talking about Gallup versus Gallup. But, you know, every year they come out with numbers on, you know, people who identify, what percentage of people identify themselves as Democrats or Republicans or independents. Well, in 2008, 36% of their sample were self-identified Democrats. That was the highest number ever.
Wow.
And in 2010, it was 31%. That was the lowest number ever.
Mm-hmm,
we went from the highest to the lowest in 2 years. The Republicans went from 28% to 29%. So those 5 points didn't go to the Republicans. The independents went from 34% to 38%. That was the highest percentage of independents ever. And it's the first time there were more independents than Republicans or Democrats. And to me, I mean, all of that, you look at all of that, and it says the Democrats got fed up of voting for Democrats and ended up seeing Republican agendas being enacted, even though we were in the majority. And they said, we're not going to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And they stayed home. And that's what happened. This was not a call for Democrats to move to the right. This was a call for Democrats to, pardon my expression, you know, grow a set of balls. And
right.
Like Democrats.
Right.
I hope I can say that. Can I say that on the radio?
Yeah. We've said worse. I just try to, you know, anyway, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. And another thing I want to point out too is that your campaign with Ray Almet, as right wing as Ray Almet truly is, and basically
Ryan, we should get his Ryan Almet.
Oh, Ryan Almet. Okay, I actually had a friend named Ray Almet one time. That's why I keep doing that. So anyway, Ryan Almet is almost had Tea Party leanings in the way his philosophy was, but on the other hand, he was a very civil kind of guy, and I was happy.
He ran a clean campaign. I did too. I will tell you. I mean, I did a lot of research on Ryan Almet.
Yeah.
And he, you know, it's very clear to me that he is extremely conservative, bordering on reactionary.
Yeah.
But there was no way I could really credibly talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of so I just ran as who I am, and I did point out, you know, he seemed to go, he ran a very low profile campaign. I think he tried to stay out of the limelight. He didn't, at least in public, he steered away from expressing some of the views that I know he has that are rather extreme.
I was impressed with him because of the fact that he wasn't mean-spirited, as so many people can be. I especially, you know, the teabag people and what some of the different campaigns that were being run were, like, horrific. And he really did. He had social graces. He seemed to really enjoy the public, and I appreciate that about him. That's
We were both commended for running a civil campaign.
And that's what my point is. You both were, yeah.
But I must tell you that I worry about him because I know he's much more conservative than the voters probably realized.
Oh, I don't think that the voters had any idea how conservative he really is.
And I do believe he's being groomed for bigger things, and mm-hmm. That's a concern.
Yes, it is. I mean, to be true about it, it is. So he has quite a job ahead of him, and he's going to be fighting the single-payer movement in Harrisburg. He will be one of them that will.
And he will be defending the, you know, one of the things I did point out, and because it found it totally shocking, he and I were on a television news interview together, and mm-hmm. the issue of the Marcellus Shale came up, which is the...
Now, there's another very important point, yeah.
Right, and you know, every state in the United States has a severance tax, which is really an extraction tax. It's a mm-hmm. tax on the minerals that are removed from the ground because they're not renewable.
Yes.
And Pennsylvania is the only state that doesn't have a severance tax. And there are a lot of other reasons to be concerned about drilling in the Marcellus Shale because we don't really know it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And it is potentially a land-bound BP. It could, you know, has the potential to destroy our water table. But all that aside... he described the severance tax as, you know, not a bad idea, a dangerous idea. You know, for corporate, you know. Well, I find that rather scary. I mean.
Yeah, I see that.
you know, it's one thing to, you know, and he seemed to feel that we should not tax corporations at all. We should probably just hand them billions of dollars and, you know,
well,
and trust
yeah, he
do the right thing with it. But, you know, and he expressed that. I mean, that's because
he's a status quo Republican.
Right. An extraction tax on the natural gas industry a dangerous idea to me is...
Oh, that's sad. That's sad.
It's not sad. It's scary.
It is. It is very frightening. So anyway,
I thought that
tonight
was a very strange word to use.
I agree. Tonight we actually covered a whole array of topics. I think that this was a great show. We covered the single-payer issues here in the country and going state by state. And I love the fact that we got to cover what you learned by running for political office, Jerry. That was really cool. And the Kennedy assassination and... We actually ran the whole gamut, so we've come to the end of this program.
That's kind of an eclectic range of issues, isn't it?
I know, and I'm going to get people to listen to this because it's archived and everything else, so that will be fun. Do you have anything else you want to say?
Oh, not that I can think of.
I know. I think it would be really fun to bring you and Jim Douglas on it.
I've never met Jim
Douglas,
and I've talked to him on the phone. I would love to meet him sometime.
Well, like I said, we could probably have the two of you talk about the Kennedy assassination, and that would be fun.
Right.
Well,
and you know, we have two other JFK experts right here in Lancaster, and
yeah, we could get them to come on.
Trainer.
I just think it's disturbing, you know, to talk about it, but I think also to have a bunch of you guys on at the same time would really be fun, so I'm going to work on that. And that's about it. So,
well, I've enjoyed it. It was fun.
I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I look forward to bringing you back on again in some other exciting capacity. And good luck to you in your political future.
Thank you. I'm not sure there's a political future, but it, you know, I may do it again. I may do it again, but, you know,
yeah.
I need to rest.
Know.
You know, one of the things you also find out the day after the election is, you know, you just want to sleep for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
thank you, Jerry. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I'm just going to play music for Mother and Child, and I will talk with you soon. Good night.